Hello, everybody, and welcome to the extended free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie, all about B-Movie. I'm one of your hosts for this one, Bob Mackey, and currently my hair is slicked back with honey. I don't recommend it. And who is here with me today, as always?
I am waiting to stop thinking B. It's Henry Gilbert.
I think we're all waiting for that. But I'll tell everybody out there, we spent a lot of time in 2024 covering good movies, things like the Disney Renaissance and things of a similar caliber. We decided to kick off the fall season, let's cover something we all know is bad, and that something is Jerry Seinfeld's first and so far only animated film, B-Movie.
Yeah, we're thinking B. We are talking about one of the most disliked animated films, and I'd say, well, someday maybe we will do every DreamWorks movie, but this is probably the worst DreamWorks movie.
It's down there. It's down there in the lowest ranking of the DreamWorks. So on this preview, you're going to hear a bit of the 90-minute history of B-Movie. But if you want to hear the rest of the history, including a behind-the-scenes expose and our full discussion of the entire film, beat by beat, joke by joke, and failed joke by failed joke, head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. And when you do, you'll unlock the rest of this podcast and also the previous nearly six entire years of What a Cartoon Movie. Those are all 3 to 6 hour long podcasts. We've covered everything in the Disney 90s Renaissance. We've covered all the Toy Story movies. We've covered one-off weirdo movies like Rocko's Modern Life, Static Cling. We've covered both Beavis and Butthead films, The Secret of Nim, Studio Ghibli stuff, two animated Batman films. The list goes on and on and on. If we haven't covered something that you like, odds are we're going to be covering it very, very soon. And that's just the $10 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. And when you sign up for that level, you get all the $5 stuff. Henry, what is happening there?
We have so many bonuses. We have been doing those from the beginning. Over 180. We're probably getting close to 200 exclusive $5 a month podcasts. Each month, we cover Talking Futurama and Talk King of the Hill, a different episode of those that we go as in-depth into as B-Movie, though usually we're much happier doing those. And we have covered up to the Comedy Central years of Futurama, and we've nearly finished the third season of King of the Hill. You can hear the entire back catalog covering those episodes, plus us covering every episode of The Critic, every episode of Mission Hill, and many of our favorite episodes of Batman, the animated series. That's all there in addition to the giant back catalog at the $10 level you get of the What a Cartoon Movie podcast that now will include B-Movie as well. It's all at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
And if you've never signed up for Patreon before, it's very easy to do so. Once you sign up, you can use any podcast app or program you might have on your phone or on your computer or what have you to listen to all of our bonus podcasts alongside all of your free podcasts as part of your podcasting lifestyle. It's just that easy, folks. So thanks for listening. We hope we didn't bug you with this little commercial here. So get ready to hear a preview of the history of B-Movie. Yes,
gee!
Flying here and buzzing there.
I'm loving the views.
Listen to me, cousin. Every buzzer must choose to be a bee.
Or not to be.
Start thinking bee.
But let's talk about the history of B-Movie. So we mentioned up front Jerome Seinfeld. He was a star of the mega hit sitcom The Seinfeld Chronicles, later renamed Seinfeld. That show wraps in 1998. And while all of his co-stars try and mostly fail to move on from their previous roles, like you said, Henry, we're all asking, what's he going to do next? And if he does do something, it's going to be good. So I want to cover like what exactly he was doing from 1998, for I guess May of 98 when the Seinfeld ends, to November of 2007 when this movie hits theaters. So the answer is not a whole lot. Outside of the stand-up special, I'm Telling You for the Last Time, and the documentary Comedian, Jerry wasn't doing a whole lot after moving back to New York outside of stand-up. He is one of those stand-up psychos like Dana Gould and Jay Leno where they consider it a science. All they want to do is do dates and go on tours. They don't really care about projects that much. They are just addicted to the stand-up environment.
Yeah, I watched that Comedian documentary when it was relatively new, when I was more into watching stand-up than I am now. But I think that Jerry Seinfeld has so many, like, honestly boring opinions about being a stand-up. I do love the art of stand-up, but also I think that some of the most, like, proud, overly backpatty people are the Jerry Seinfelds of the world talking up how much they love stand-up.
Yeah, the documentary was about Jerry and an up-and-comer, Orny Adams, I believe the guy was. I don't think he really went on to do anything special, but I'm sure he's still working. But there's some things I really like about Jerry Seinfeld's attention to the craft. But yeah. I think he has become too obsessive when it comes to the science of telling a joke. And I know when I would write comedy, I know word choice matters and sentence structure matters and the flow and the punchlines. Those all really matter. But I think he just became too analytical and he forgot it's possible to just be funny on the fly. It's possible. And then, you know, I started listening to improv and improv podcasts and I thought like, oh, people can just be funny without there being this linguistic science as to how a joke is structured. And Comedian is really about him and his joke writing and joke telling process.
And I also one of those things, I remember a special that now I look back on is like, horrible. But I was drawn to it because it was like, okay, Louis C.K., Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, they're all talking about the craft of stand-up together. But also there is Ricky Gervais. And I'm just like, how dare, like looking back on it, like, how dare you? Like, he is not a good stand-up. Like, he thought because he wrote The Office and he has respect. Like, he thought he could also be a stand-up, but it's just him on stage bitching.
I remember watching his stand-up in the video game Grand Theft Auto 4, and I thought, oh, Ricky Gervais, I love the British Office. What is a stand-up like? And then I was like, oh, okay, I don't really need to invest any more attention in this.
No. And how dare he be there to tell the other, like, I remember thinking then, how dare he tell, like, three of the greatest stand-ups alive? Like, he's like, you know what? You're on stage. You should do this. I'm like, shut the fuck up, Ricky Gervais.
A lot of people have been saying that for a very long time. So Jerry Seinfeld not doing a lot. We have him doing a ton of stand-up. We also have those American Express commercials where he's hanging out with Superman, which is kind of like a Seinfeld sequel. It was an advertising campaign. Superman was animated, directed by Barry Levinson, who was in this movie, by the way. So that was putting Jerry back out on television, making us remember him. And it was around this time I was watching a lot of Seinfeld reruns. I did a complete Seinfeld rewatch in the early 2010s. I really love the show and I want to revisit it. So I'm going into this loving Jerry Seinfeld and having a lot of nostalgia for the things he used to do.
Yeah, no, I should say I watched Seinfeld. I started watching it as a new show in like season 4 or 5. I was one of the people who didn't watch it until it got syndicated. And then when I saw it in syndication, I was like, oh, this is so great. This is so funny. And then I was every must-see TV watcher of it and was watching it a ton in reruns, though I didn't. Unlike other TV on DVD things, I don't think I bought the DVDs for Seinfeld. Maybe because I had heard the commentaries were like nothing and no good. And I was buying for commentary then.
I think I might have bought the first couple of seasons. And I will say that was the golden age of DVD extras. And there were so many. I think the commentaries were pretty good. And they also had the pop-up video thing for every episode that just like hit you with all of this trivia. I wish there was some way to retain that in a, you know, streaming format. But I know those DVDs are pretty good. It was the last time any TV on DVD could be that good.
Oh, okay. Well, I was misinformed then. I should have given him a chance.
I'm sure if you go on Amazon right now, you can get the entire series box set for $20, and it comes with a little puffy shirt you can't wear.
I don't want to wear a puffy shirt.
See, I'm going to say our Seinfelds are not good, but mostly because he spends so much time screaming in this movie, and I don't want to wreck my voice.
He's in his like 50s making this. So I'm impressed with, or late 40s. I'm impressed with his ability to scream.
I think he's in his early 50s, but yeah, the entire movie he's doing this. See, whenever I my voice cracks, I end up turning into Gary Marshall. It's not good. The mic is too hot. I'm too, I guess, Irish English to lapse into the Jerry voice without it seeming insulting.
You do mention, yeah, Comedian also frames it as he moves back to New York because he hated living in L.A. He's a New York guy. He had to produce the show in L.A., so he gets to live in New York the whole time. Well, meanwhile, like Larry David stays in L.A. and makes that his entire TV show for Curb, Your Enthusiasm, which is about him complaining about rich man problems in Los Angeles.
And I haven't watched the last couple seasons of that show, but I watched like 6 or 7 seasons. And I think it's great. It's not as good as Seinfeld. I think the Seinfeld reunion season is the last one I watched, and I kind of tapped out there. But yeah, I mean, that the same spirit carries on there. But there's just something I miss about the kind of normal people of Seinfeld. I can only deal with the problems of a rich man for so long when I'm watching Curb Your Enthusiasm. I know that's the point. Like, even though he's rich, he's still miserable. But I kind of got over it after a while.
The mockumentary looseness of it bothers me sometimes. I do think the some people play better than others, but they have to like, well, we got this celebrity here. We gotta like edit their improv into something when some people aren't funny. But meanwhile, on Seinfeld, the sitcom, they wrote those scripts very tightly. Mm-hmm. There definitely was improvisation in it, but the script writing was part of why you loved it, which just isn't there in Curb. So if improv fails, then it fails bad.
I think I just prefer the super tight sitcom writing of the Seinfeld TV show. Now, normally when we start these podcasts, these histories, we start with Wikipedia. We don't end there. We go to Wikipedia. We see, okay, here's a summary of the production. Here are a ton of articles that are linked. Here are a ton of books that are linked. Let's go seek these out and read these in full. Well, I will tell you, the Wikipedia entry for B-Movie is one paragraph in terms of the production, because there's not a lot of stories to tell in terms of how did this movie get made? It's not very interesting. So I had to go out and be a little industrious. So luckily, the Vancouver Library System had the hardcover Art of B-Movie.
Wow.
I'm probably the only person who ever took this out of the library. Hardcover, written by Jerry Beck. How many copies did this sell? I don't know, but I was able to flip through it and read what little text there is and get a little more out of the production of the movie, learn a little bit more about the production of the movie.
Cartoon historian Jerry Beck wrote that?
Yeah, I think he was doing a lot of art of books for DreamWorks at the time, or just he was the guy you would go to put the little blurbs in your art of books. So that exists. And I will say, yeah, the 2D art is amazing. The 2D art is very appealing. It looks way better than this. I hate this era for CGI movies outside of a few Pixar things. And then when I watched, deleted scenes on the DVD or Blu-ray rather, and I watched deleted endings, they're all done in hand-drawn animatic. And I thought, if the movie looked like this, the writing would not be any better, but I would find it so much more enjoyable. I just hate how this looks, and I feel like we didn't really nail good CGI movies until the early 2010s. There are some things I like, the Toy Stories I like, some other Pixar stuff I like, but I feel like we really couldn't match the expressiveness of 2D until we started rolling into the 2010s and people were able to break the character models more and use more advanced systems to make the animation more expressive. And now we have things like the Ninja Turtles movie and Into the Spider-Verse and a lot of more expressive ways to animate characters. This is just Dullsville to me.
I think next month's movie actually did really drive forward a lot of of that kind of animation in 3D while still having it be like the popping posing of 2D, like Hotel Transylvania.
That is what actually got me interested in watching CGI movies again. Unfortunately, I didn't watch it, but I thought, they're actually doing something new. They're trying to emulate 2D animation. And of course, like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs was another one of those that looked interesting, but I didn't see until my adult life. So some people are out there doing this. Not everybody is trying, and B-Movie is playing it very close to the vest here. So the Blu-ray does retain all the DVD features, and there are fucking too many features on this Blu-ray. No one could possibly want this much information about B-Movie, but I will say thank you for retaining it on the Blu-ray. All of these deleted scenes, all of the whole ad campaign spots, all of the trailers and deleted endings, there's just so much going on. A music video for We Got the Bee, I don't think that appears in the movie at all.
What? This is insane.
Yeah, some cover of We've Got the Beat, but it's they renamed it We've Got the Bee, and I don't know who actually sings it. It's very odd.
That is insane. I mean, I definitely remember the ad campaign. I don't know who to credit it more to, like Katzenberg or Seinfeld himself, but saying like these ads need to show little of the movie itself. What it needs to show is Jerry Seinfeld, the man, telling you he has a new movie out, or he's in a silly bee costume telling you about it.
Yeah, like occasionally he'll be there with his best friend Chris Rock to let you know it's safe to see this movie because there's people you like in it. So I want to say, thankfully, we are very lucky that one of our patrons happened to work on the film and work directly with Jerry Seinfeld himself. So we have a lot of inside dirt you won't find anywhere else. And thank you so much to this patron for sending us so much behind-the-scenes info. We'll get to that further into our history segment of this podcast.
So, yes, thank you very, very much for your many wonderful insights for sending it on. That was very helpful. But, yeah, you get the official Jerry Beck book version and also some behind-the-scenes secrets.
You get the fly on the wall or perhaps bee on the wall perspective.
Oh.
I would never say that. So how does Bee Movie begin? The answer is as a joke. So Seinfeld is having dinner at Steven Spielberg's beach house in the Hamptons. And by the way, Steven Spielberg was a part of the marketing campaign for this movie because he obviously is a DreamWorks guy. And then he also is helping Jerry figure out how to write a movie. And he's coming in for meetings and stuff. So Spielberg is kind of hands-on with Bee Movie in a way I don't like. So yeah, they're rich people. They're having dinner in the Hamptons. Jerry, he's very flippant. He's very glib. He throws out a joke like, what if I made a movie called Bee Movie and I was a bee? And Steven Spielberg is like, holy shit. Jeffrey Katzenberg has been trying to get him into a movie for years. Let's make this happen. So this starts a series of phone calls to Jeffrey Katzenberg, and this is how Bee Movie is put into production. So this happens in, I think, like early 2003, based on the general timeline of the film. So the entire movie is based on some dumb pun joke Jerry just threw out during dinner, but Spielberg and Katzenberg pounced on that as a way to get Jerry Seinfeld behind an animated movie. So this is a movie nobody wanted to make, except for the people profiting from it. Jerry Seinfeld doesn't care about insects. He just threw out a glib observation over dinner, and people thought they saw dollar signs.
Well, and it depends on you knowing the old saying of a B movie as like a secondary feature in a double feature.
Yes, exactly. And I think that pun was lost to people in 2007, and it's definitely lost to people today. And when I hear about Unfrosted, it is full of all of these jokes that would have been in something Seinfeld wrote in the 90s. But now when they show up in a 2024 film, you're like, what's going on here? Why is this in a new movie? This joke is so old, and who understands this joke?
That is the key to the problem of Jerry Seinfeld as a comedian in general, is that he stopped being a normal person in like 1988, probably, maybe even earlier. And so he's just crystallized there. And he's like, yeah, a B movie. Everybody knows a B movie. He is lucky that cereal has remained similar. So maybe he's like, all right, Pop-Tarts, I can do that. Though also that's, I believe Unfrosted is sort of like set in a specific time frame, like his own childhood, so yeah. Maybe that prevents it from being too dated. I don't know.
I guess it's dated on purpose because he was around when Pop-Tarts were new, and it's about his fascination with the Pop-Tart, how that led to a line of thinking that eventually created a movie. But he really is trapped, and you ever noticed that those kind of comedians from the 80s and early 90s, that is still his sense of humor and point of view, and that was a phase of stand-up comedy that we really have moved past.
And from the descriptions of Unfrosted I've heard, it did remind me of the experience of watching this Bee movie, which is that it feels like it's not a full story. It's just a collection of sketches around a barely held together idea of like, what is a bee? Huh? I don't know.
I'm not watching it for research. I'm sorry. I had to watch Bee Movie a few times, and that was enough. You know, it's fun to talk about doing Bee Movie, but then you have to sit down and you're just reading about the history of Bee Movie for two full work days, and it's not so fun anymore. But we're going to have fun on this podcast, I swear. I'm already having fun. So yeah, Steven Spielberg calls Jeffrey Katzenberg. And again, Katzenberg has been trying to talk Seinfeld into being a character voice in a DreamWorks movie for years. And yes, this little wisecrack leads to a journey that begins the production of a film with a $150 million budget. So essentially, this is Jerry Seinfeld being gifted an animated film because of his stature in the comedy world. It's not something he believed in. It's not a project he's been trying to get made. It's not about a subject matter he cares about. It just is an opportunity to just shove him into the DreamWorks formula.
You know, I could see Jerry Seinfeld. This is impressive on some level to me that like Jerry Seinfeld could have easily just done, like, let's say Gary Shandling, similar stature of comedians, a little bit older, not that much though, but they both did a DreamWorks thing. But Gary Shandling is just like, he's a turtle in Over the Hedge. He's like the boring turtle, and it's not built around it being the Gary Shandling vehicle. He just did his lines and left. He was just a voice actor for it. Jerry Seinfeld clearly didn't want to just be a voice in somebody else's project. It had to be his own idea, and he has to be the center of it. He can't just act in somebody else's thing. It is actually very rare he chooses to not be in control of his project. Like, maybe he's a control freak, but it was a more artistically honest choice, I guess, to not just take the paycheck to be any old voice in any old DreamWorks film.
Now, every time you say B, I'm just thinking you're trying to make a pun, but the word B exists independently of the word B-E-E, by the way, folks.
Yes, yes.
So yeah, Jerry is rooted on the East Coast. Production begins on B-Movie at DreamWorks in Glendale, California. I was reading some articles at the time. They make a huge deal about he's using this thing called video conferencing, so he never has to leave New York, and it's all something we're doing today. I'm doing this right now as I record a podcast with Henry. But back in 2007, it was a much bigger deal to video conference across the country to write your B film.
I guess, to have a stable enough connection, you need to be on the millionaire and billionaire lists that Jeffrey Katzenberg was on to get that going, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I guess now it's available to non-billionaires. So, and this is, I think this is how, like, all television shows are written now, because no one wants to pay for office space and you got the right. Mini rooms and stuff. Yeah, I think, was it Disenchantment that was all remote?
After the first season, I think so, yeah. Yeah. I think we did get to visit the writer's room for the first season. But yeah, I think most things are remote now. Now everybody can be as nitpicking from another time zone as Jerry Seinfeld, I'm sure, was on this production.
So I'm going to put a pin in the history for now, and we're going to move on to talk about the various people who worked on the movie. And for you listeners on the free feed, I will tell you, this behind-the-scenes segment coming up at the end of the history segment will only be available to people on the Patreon. So if you want to hear the inside dirt on Jerry Seinfeld, you have to go to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. And then you get a bunch of other stuff, too. It's great. But I'm just focusing on the dirt that was sent to us by a patron. And it's nothing bad. It's just someone hears what Jerry Seinfeld is like and here are all the things that are really not documented in the history of the B-movie. But I swear to God, it's very interesting, which is why we're holding it ransom behind the paywall.
Yep. Yeah. Though, come on, get on it. There's so many cool things there.
Yes. And hey, if you paid for this and you're listening to this, I'll say this right now. Thank you for being patient. Now let's move on to people who worked on the movie. So for this project, Seinfeld brings in writers from his own orbit. Mostly very talented guys who really shouldn't have made something like B-Movie. So let's go over them here. And these are the writers, of course, Jerry Seinfeld. I don't need to tell you who he is. He's Jerry Seinfeld. Go watch Seinfeld. It's great. The end. So let's move on to the other writers. The first writer is Spike Ferriston. So pertaining to our interest, he wrote the Season 7 Simpsons episode, Sideshow Bob's Last Gleaming, as a freelancer. But he kicked off a long writing career with 5 years on David Letterman before moving on to The Dana Carvey Show, Space Ghost, Coast to Coast, and then Seinfeld. So just amazing comedy writing pedigree, Spike Ferriston. At Seinfeld, he wrote 10 episodes over the final 3 seasons, including the immortal The Soup Nazi. And weirdly enough, he had Fox's longest running late night talk show called Talk Show with Spike Ferriston. It ran on Saturday nights from 2006 to 2009. And he was also one of the creators of the short-lived The Michael Richards Show, and unfortunately, one of the writers of Unfrosted. I believe The Michael Richards Show, he was playing a lawyer or something. It lasted one season on NBC.
Yeah, I recall, I only recall, like, for a stunt, he, like, shaved part of his head for something in it. Or maybe I'm thinking of a different Michael Richards show where he was, like, a detective. But yeah, Spike Ferriston, I totally forgot that he is a Simpsons writer and another of those, the Letterman to Simpsons pipeline and then back on to Seinfeld. And I mean, yeah, writing the Soup Nazi episode, that alone should get you, you know, TV Hall of Fame level notoriety.
I find the Soup Nazi very funny because it was when we were using the word Nazi a lot more flippantly in the 90s.
Yes.
We were making a lot of Nazi and Hitler jokes, not knowing that, you know, white supremacy was still a thing and people still wore swastikas and everything. And I like how the man it was based on, he wanted to cash in on that fame, but he couldn't call himself a Nazi for understandable reasons. So I remember in the early aughts or late 90s, he put out a cookbook, like, here are all the soups. And of course, it's not, by the Soup Nazi. I think he was called the Original Soup Guy.
The Original Soup.
It's a way to avoid saying, I'm the Nazi. But wait. It's pertaining to my behavior, not my belief system.
It's now, who wants some soup, huh? Like, yeah.
Delicious.
God. No, the actor who played him forever, you see him in anything, and the character actor, you're like, oh, hey, and it stars the Soup Nazi. The Soup Nazi's in this, too. Like, you're still, that's what I would say to any person like, oh, and in this movie also is the soup Nazi, you know, that guy.
So yeah, Spike Feresten, very interesting guy. I never saw his talk show or even knew about it, but he just seems to be involved in a lot of great projects, and then this, and also on Frosted.
Hey, it to be counted on is one of Seinfeld's top guys for what is probably a long rewriting process. Probably pays pretty good.
Another top Seinfeld guy on this project is Andy Robin, who is the other creator of The Michael Richards Show. He started his career at SNL, quickly jumped to Seinfeld. He wrote 12 episodes, some with writing partner Greg Cavett, and he wrote The Junior Mint, one of the most famous episodes of Seinfeld.
Oh, that's another classic. Yeah, okay. So he's comfortable with these two guys. At least though, with Spike, you've got one animation credit prior to this.
Yes, yes. He knows how to write for a yellow thing, be it Homer or Barry B. Benson. So yeah, Andy Robin, he writes and directs an independent comedy that no one has seen. It's called Live Free or Die. Zooey Deschanel is in an early role. I don't know how it is. But after B-Movie, he doesn't do very much, and that's because he became a licensed therapist, though he returned to Hollywood to help write Unfrosted, I think undoing a lot of the mental well-being he fostered in his years of helping people through their problems.
Yeah, that's you're getting the black out of your ledger there and putting more red in there with that. Like that's so funny. It's enough of this. I want to help people. And then when a project is good, as Unfrosted comes to you, you gotta take it.
You have to put your life of benevolence behind you and write the best movie of 2024. This is related, by the way, related to our interests. So allow me to be self-indulgent here. This guy became a therapist. And I've been spending some time on the Mystery Science Theater Reddit, reading up on where certain people ended up on the show. And one of the creators, Jim Mallon, the voice and puppeteer for Gypsy and, a big force on the show for good and for ill, I found out that he also became a licensed therapist. So if you need therapy in Hopkins, Minnesota, you can get your meeting with the guy who played Gypsy and helped create Mystery Science Theater 3000. But I'm sure he would not like for you to make that the subject of the conversation.
Wow, that is shocking, especially because most stories about the behind the scenes of the show don't make him seem like a very therapeutic figure or a helpful one.
No, it seems like he went through a lot. He curbed a lot of addictions, and he had a sort of redemption, a self-redemption. So he seems to have been evened out by now. But that's where Jim Mallon ended up, if you're wondering.
That's crazy. I had no clue, man. That's. I hope he's at least enjoying the big payday he got from selling his rights in MST3K to Shout Factory. I would think that was probably a pretty good one.
It put him through college, literally. Moving on, the third writer on the film is Barry Martyr. I want to say that Barry B. Benson is probably named after him. So this is a stand-up guy that Jerry Seinfeld knows. And outside of stand-up, he hasn't done a lot of writing for anything notable except the mid-90s fake daytime talk show Nightstand with Dick Dietrich. Which I remember because it was on E! Late night, like after Howard Stern. So it was a fake talk show with the guy who would eventually star in the Howard Stern Baywatch parody Son of the Beach.
Yes, right. Yes, a guy who's intentionally ugly man. Or like he's trying to look as pitiful as possible. It was a Jerry Seinfeld parody. I remember spending a few late nights watching it because I think very quickly I figured out it was a satire of talk shows, and I liked it all right.
And I'm pretty sure, again, Barry B. Benson is named after him. Jerry, by the way, seems to love this guy. And on the commentary, he is just delighted by him. And I got to say, the commentary is fun because I don't think Jerry likes this movie. And he's always asking, like, why is this blue? Why does this guy look like that guy? He's pointing out all the things my wife and I were talking to each other about while watching this movie, like how all the like NPCs in the world look the same. And right. And then on the commentary, Barry is just like, why does a bee have a mustache? I don't understand it. And it just he's constantly trolling the creators of the bee movie besides him.
That's so funny. It's like, well, you made it, I'm sure most of his answers are because it's hard to draw these things or it's hard to animate the stuff you wanted to have on. We need to cut shortcuts.
Yeah, on the commentary, Jerry Seinfeld is saying, oh, those animators, they always have an answer for you. So he knows, like, in many cases, he's being told an answer just to shut him up, where it's the animators will say, well, we have to do it this way. He's like, why don't you do it that way? Oh, we have to do it this way. It's the way the computers work. I'm sure they understood he knew very little about the process.
Though, I believe those animators, if they said, putting 10,000 bees on screen is actually very difficult, Jerry. You can't just write in a script and then 10,000 bees attack or lift up a plane or whatever.
But they had to do it because he's Jerry Seinfeld.
Yes.
So more about Barry Martyr. This is something I didn't know. So under the pseudonym Ted L. Nancy, he has published books of prank letters and their real responses. The series is called Letters from a Nut. And if you're interested in checking that out, that's what the series is called.
Huh.
And Martyr and Seinfeld really wanted to get this made into a TV show throughout the 2000s. And apparently at least two or possibly three pilots were created based on this premise. So it ended up being turned into a play when the pilot didn't work. One of the performances of the play became a direct-to-streaming movie in 2019. So if you want to see what Letters from a Nut is, there's a 2019 streaming version of it on like Apple TV and Amazon Prime. So I'd never heard about this, but I saw in the talking about this movie, a lot of people's like, oh, it's the Letters from a Nut guy. So I think it was a popular book series in the 90s.
Okay, man, I am shocked. Like, if even today, Jerry Seinfeld comes to you with that pitch, Netflix orders it full season immediately, right? You would think it's like, oh, we'll put out 10 episodes no matter how it turns out.
Yeah, I'm surprised they just couldn't get this to work. I think they were working with FX and a few other cable networks. But yeah, this Letters from a Nut thing, it never happened. I'm sure the pilots are somewhere. And yes, Barry Martyr is one of the Unfrosted guys as well. Unfrosted is a reunion of the B-movie writers, if anything. It's crazy.
The B-movie guys come together to make a thing that's even more hated.
And now we can go over the people behind the animation. So there are two directors on the film. The first one is Simon J. Smith. He joined DreamWorks Animation in 1997, back when it was still Pacific Data Images. And Smith played a big part in some of their earliest features and was head of layout on both Ants and Shrek. So big vital part of getting these early DreamWorks movies off the ground. The CGI ones, that is.
Man, what a thankless... I was thinking that the whole time watching the movie. What a thankless position it is to be these directors on it, because you don't get to be lead interview in any of these things. If you even get invited to the interviews, like, you're lucky. Like, this is all Seinfeld. Seinfeld, I am shocked Seinfeld didn't get, even though it would make no sense as far as the Animation Guild goes, that he wasn't able to get a director credit on this anyway.
Yeah, I was really surprised. Maybe he was willing to give that up to people who are actually working on the film, because he was likely getting a huge monetary reward for being part of this. But, you know, seeing not directed by Jerry Seinfeld was a surprise to me upon watching this for the first time. And I really feel like when we go over the histories of these guys, I feel like at the time these DreamWorks directors were basically just cogs, because this didn't elevate them in any way. And we weren't talking about their names. Like, oh, Smith and Hickner, I love their films. Some of the first things he directed were Shrek related, like the animation for the Shrek ride and a Shrek short. And after B-Movie, he went on to direct a few more subjects for DreamWorks, short subjects, and he went on to co-direct the feature Penguins of Madagascar. So this is kind of it for him at DreamWorks. After this, he went on to work on the show Baymax Dreams, and he was most recently a supervising producer on Batwheels, the show that asks, what if the Batman characters were cars? I think it would go something like this.
I hope that successfully sells a lot of toys. You know, I only know that Baymax show because, like, a canonically gay character appears in it. So every once in a while, if there's a canonically gay cartoon character, I'll hear about it. But and really, it's more like they just have, like, a rainbow pin in the background.
Yeah. I just remember, I think conservatives got really mad at this because Baymax asked about gender one time because he's a robot learning about the world. And, of course, they were mad for the reasons you would suspect.
Voiced by Mr. Show superstar Scott Adsit.
That is crazy. I don't know how that happened.
I just watched a commercial for the new, there's San Francisco, a real one, and they built into Disney California Adventure. And I watched a video of Scott Adsit walking around there and buying Baymax food and hanging out with people. I was like, wow, how strange. How strange to see this from the guy who played the masturbating expert on the Monster Mash sketch.
Yeah, I have not seen that movie yet, and I played the Kingdom Hearts 3 level. I got the gist of it, but maybe one of these days I'll... Is it a Marvel thing? Is it like a Marvel property?
Well, it isn't not a Marvel thing. Okay. Like, it did get published as a Marvel comic first, but it is fully independent of Marvel as a film. Though Stan Lee does have a cameo in it.
So the other director is Steve Hickner. He goes way further back than Smith in terms of his work history. He was working in the animation industry as early as the early 80s. He did storyboards for things like Black Star, The New Adventures of Zorro, He-Man, Pac-Man, and a lot of other slop. But at the same time, he worked on things with good animation. I think he was a Richard Williams guy because he did animation for Ziggy's Gift. He also worked at Disney on The Black Cauldron and The Great Mouse Detective, and he was animation production coordinator for Who Framed Roger Rabbit, so splitting his time between Williams and Disney and also like doing storyboards for Pac-Man. So he just was finding work where he could get it.
You have to be, on that level of theatrical while still also doing like Pac-Man crap like that. I guess that just shows you the lack of options in the 80s mm-hmm. for a good animator then. Jesus.
It was a dark time. So Steve Hickner was also a producer on a lot of the Amblimation movies of the early 90s. And then he moved over to DreamWorks for his first directing gig. And those movies, I think, were Five Will Goes West, I think Balto, and maybe We're Back, A Dinosaur Story.
Yeah. That, you know, that We're Back one, I someday we'll cover that. I want to, because it's just so interesting that, like, I believe it is that, like, Spielberg and Bluth had a fallout. Spielberg then just hires a bunch of Bluth guys to, he's like, we don't need Bluth for this. I can just get you guys for that. Once DreamWorks started, Amblimation just kind of became DreamWorks Animation.
Yeah. And so after Amblimation, he is one of the first guys at DreamWorks, and he actually is co-director of Prince of Egypt. So with, what's her name?
Brenda Chapman.
There you go. Thank you. I'm sorry if I forgot her name. It was written down somewhere in my notes. But yeah, he directs. That's their first animated film? Or did Ants come first?
Yeah, well, Ants did beat it out the door, actually, unfortunately. Sad to say.
But it was the same year, right?
Yes. Yeah, they were both 98.
Yeah, Ants had to get out before A Bug's Life, and then The Prince of Egypt, rather, came out after Bug's Life, like in December, I think.
And that was supposed to be their big prestige move, was The Prince of Egypt. But then what it turned out, sadly, is Ants was much more of a tone setter for what DreamWorks Animation would be. Celebrity-driven CGI comedy where the CGI creature on screen looks like a famous person.
Yeah, they didn't care about prestige after a while. They're like, let's just make Will Smith a fish. How about it?
Yes.
What would happen if Will Smith was a fish? Well, there was a whole movie about it.
This movie makes me, honestly, I would rather watch Shark Tale than Bee Movie, for sure.
I guess one element of the production is they wanted to make the bee look like Jerry Seinfeld, and he saw drawings, and he was like, don't do that. And I think at least if it looked like Jerry Seinfeld, I'd have some Pavlovian response associating his voice with and face with funny things. Instead, it's just this like 20-year-old nobody, and some of the voices in this movie don't feel like they fit the character designs at all.
Yeah, no, I definitely not. Though in some cases, like Renee Zellweger, I feel like they just made her character be Debbie. They just make her, they draw her to be her, and Patrick Warburton just looks like a Patrick Warburton guy, but others, they do not fit. There's several that I'm like, that doesn't, especially when it's like Ray Liotta, does not look like Ray Liotta to me.
I like the Ray Liotta caricature. It's hideous. The celebrity caricatures are funny in this movie, like Larry King and Sting and Ray Liotta. I kind of wanted more of that because the bees are just so boring. I hate how these bees look. They're just so bland.
I agree with that.
And it feels narcissistic to be like, I'm going to play a 20-year-old guy with cool sneakers.
Yes. Yeah. I mean,
it's like, Jerry, you're 53. I see how much you're balding in the promotional videos for this movie.
Well, I mean, that mentally, he still is at a guy who just graduated college. Like, that's where he remains to this day, mm-hmm. I would say. I actually was proud of Jerry for just going bald publicly, and like his hair is, you know, getting lighter and lighter every time you saw him. And then, I feel like in the last 2 years for Unfrosted, he decided, no, I have hair now.
Yeah.
Let's not comment on how I grew back hair.
He did the whole Jeremy Piven rollback where, who was bald? Not me. Yeah, I guess around this time, we're talking about his hair, which I guess is kind of petty, but around this time, he was still doing the poofy hair, but it was kind of hiding things. And then he went for more of, I wouldn't call it a crew cut, but like a closer cut that reflected his age more. But now I think he's back in the who lost their hair, not me kind of period of his life. As he's in his 70s now. I mean, come on.
I know. And I feel like I heard it Unfrosted. He's playing a man who's like in his 50s. So he's ready to play the part he played that he would have been the age of when he made B movie instead, where he's instead playing, again, a college graduate. Like, that's his character.
It's a little weird. But yeah, those are the directors of this movie. Oh, yeah. So back to Steve Hickner. One more thing about him. He only directed some DreamWorks shorts after this and a few episodes of Father of the Pride. So I'm sorry, ooh, Steve. And he basically has some involvement in every DreamWorks production up through the late 2010s. He might be retired now based on what his IMDb looks like. Retired or teaching, who knows?
Man, that Father of the Pride, that's an even worse thing than B-movie, I think. Like, oh, God.
It's one of those things because another podcast did it. We don't have to. Podcast The Ride covered the entire series during the pandemic. And that was a load off my back.
Thank you for cursing yourselves to that and having to hear all of the racist caricatures of this. Another very celebrity-driven, the tragedy that faced it makes the Michael Richard thing seem almost like small by comparison.
Absolutely. The words that shot out of Michael Richard's mouth didn't wound anybody.
That's true.
Not physically, at least. And the music in this film is by Rupert Gregson-Williams. He is part of the vast Hans Zimmer empire of composing. He's the brother of composer Harry Gregson-Williams. And he's mostly known as the guy who puts together the scores for all of the Happy Madison films, starting with Click. So not super notable. He does scores for big studio comedies. I don't think the score in this movie stands out at all. It's not offensive. It just is... He's doing what he's hired to do, just sort of support the jokes with light, fluffy music.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and also I don't know how much creativity you get for a score in there when probably Jerry is noting it to death of like, no, what's funny is this. Like, how much can a director or a composer really get through of their own personal taste with when you have somebody as powerful as Jerry Seinfeld to please in every major position in this movie?
Oh, that's a big part of our secret history behind the paywall.
Oh, yes. Right.
Jerry Seinfeld's many changes. We'll talk about them on the Patreon. So, also Rupert Gregson-Williams also wrote the score for the two Aquaman films. So, I don't understand that, but he went from writing like Hubie Halloween score to Aquaman.
The only musical moment I remember from the first Aquaman, and I have not seen the second Aquaman, is the octopus playing the drums. I remember that from the first Aquaman.
Maybe that was Rupert standing in for the octopus. Who knows? So let's go over the cast here before we roll into the secret history of B-movie. I don't know if I have to go into that much detail because it was a movie, animated movie of this time where you're supposed to know who everyone is going into it. A new voice would make you feel scared and stupid. So these are all familiar people. So yeah, I mentioned him up front. Jerry Seinfeld is Barry B. Benson. And I don't have to go into him. I don't think he's a good voice actor because he's not a good live action actor. He just has a lot of charisma and chemistry with that Seinfeld cast, which helps him perform in those scenes. But when he's alone in a booth screaming, and most of the movie is him screaming, it gets very, very irritating. It made me dislike hearing Jerry Seinfeld's voice, and I'm used to the voice making me happy and making me laugh and making me think of the Seinfeld sitcom.
His best moments as a voice actor in this, I think, are when he has somebody to play off of, but there are so many moments of him talking to himself alone of like, oh, what am I going to do? Or what's this? Or what's that? Like, or shouting at people and it's not a conversation.
Yeah. I normally like shouting characters and yelling in animated features. I mean, Woody does nothing but yell in Toy Story 1 and I love that film. But I think Jerry Seinfeld's yelling is just so shrill that it doesn't work constantly throughout the movie. When you're watching Seinfeld and he hits that pitch, it's usually at the climax of a comedic scene. He doesn't stay in that pitch forever. The scene usually ends when he gets that heightened. In this movie, he is that heightened for most of the running time.
Yeah, there's few of his, smug. He has a few smug lines, but none of the, some of my favorite Seinfeld lines are not the screaming of, I don't want to wear a puffy shirt or I don't want to be a pirate. It's him saying, like, when George Costanza says, I just want some things that are just for me. Is that so selfish? And then he replies, yes, I think that's the definition of selfish. Yes.
Yeah, he is really in the I don't want to be a pirate cadence throughout the entire film, the entire B movie. So yeah, that's Jerry Seinfeld. The female lead is played by Renee Zellweger. Her name is Vanessa Bloom. And this movie hits right after her peak popularity in the early aughts, thanks to things like Chicago and Bridget Jones's Diary. And she was also a major character in Shark Tale before this. So she was no stranger to the world of DreamWorks. And she was in Monsters vs. Aliens as well. And they said on the commentary, she based this character on what she said was a young Ruth Gordon from Harold and Maude. So that was her intentionality going into this character. Huh. I think this character sucks. I have no issues with the performance. There's just nothing to her. She seems insane. There are too many things in this movie that just seem clinically insane when isolated from the events of B-Movie. This woman needs help.
That does give Patrick Warburton fun things to do later, not to get ahead. But yeah, like she is an insane woman. Like she is truly nuts and would be committed to an asylum of some kind in a just world.
She would be executed for filing a lawsuit against humanity, in my opinion.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, that's treasonous for one thing. Or that the vast companies that are involved in honey production would just have her killed, too.
Yes, absolutely. She would be shot with a heart attack gun immediately by Hunex or whatever the name of the corporation is in this film. And you mentioned him, Patrick Warburton plays Ken. Yes, he is named after the famous doll that we are all familiar with now. And of course, he was Putty on Seinfeld. He was Brock Sampson on The Venture Brothers. He's the Tick on the cartoon, or sorry, on the first live action Tick. And Joe from Family Guy, very familiar voice to hear at this point in terms of cartoon voice acting. Talking about his character design, I don't like it because, again, it's one of those aughts movies where they're not breaking the character model, they're not trying to emulate 2D animation, and he is doing nothing but screaming, and I feel like his character physically does not emote enough for how much Patrick Warburton is screaming throughout this film. It just feels like this voice should not be coming out of this very stiff character, and for whatever reason, he's like a tennis guy, and I guess in earlier versions of the movie, he was a seller of fake diamonds. It was called Zymonique. A parody of Diamondique.
I see.
So many plot elements were thrown out in the creation of this movie. We'll talk about that soon.
Yeah, no, the Warburton is, well, he is very used a lot in animation by this point in 2007. Hearing him in a cartoon, you hear him in like 80 cartoons every year back then. When we covered Emperor's New Groove, him playing Kronk, it was relatively new for him to be doing a voice acting then. But by this point, he's in like so many productions and he only does his voice. So you're used to hearing it. It almost seems too obvious to pick him. The only defense Seinfeld has of like such an obvious choice is we had him first. Like they made him famous on Seinfeld as Putty. So it is more of a reunion than just obvious casting.
It's funny that Putty was so low energy on the show. I guess when he became an insane, I think it was a hockey fan. Was he a hockey fan?
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
That's when the screaming would come out. But usually he was just very low energy. But this is a very screamy role for Patrick Warburton. Joe in Family Guy would do a lot of screaming as well. It reminds me of that.
Yeah. And he's cucked by a bee. That's what his character's entire thing is.
It's weird. Moving on. John Goodman plays Leighton T. Montgomery. The fat Southern lawyer, he's just doing a very broad performance, but I think he's great in everything. And again, no stranger to voice acting. He was in Monsters, Inc. He was in Emperor's New Groove. He was in We're Back, A Dinosaur Story. I think he was in that as well. He was one of the dinosaurs.
That's right. I think that's one of his earliest movie voice acting roles. Yeah, boy, I wasn't even thinking this is a Emperor's New Groove reunion of him and Patrick Warburton.
That is true. Yeah. A lot of familiar voices, especially if you listen to What a Cartoon. And as Barry's parents, Janet and Martin Benson, we have Kathy Bates and Barry Levinson. Weirdly enough, this is not Levinson's first acting role. He has done some acting in the past. And he's obviously here because he directed those Superman commercials for American Express with Jerry Seinfeld.
Jerry watches out for his friends.
Yeah. I don't think Barry Levinson needs help, but hey, it's a paycheck thrown at him and he does a good job in this movie. And I should note that Kathy Bates announced that she's retiring after her next role, which is starring as the title character in the reboot of Matlock.
Whoa, yes, really?
They're making Matlock a lady now, and she's playing Matlock.
Boo.
Boo.
No, I'm kidding.
More like Woke Lock. Matt Woke. I don't know. Go whatever works best for you when you're tweeting about it.
But why isn't it just Murder, She Wrote? I mean, well, she can play Matlock. Matlock's a lawyer, not a writer, so it's not the same. But
yeah, Matlock's more of a Perry Mason character. Jessica Fletcher. Is that Jessica Fletcher in Murder, She
yeah,
Wrote?
Yeah, Jessica Fletcher,
I don't think
yeah.
she was in court a lot. It's more one of those shows where you solve the murder while the body is still on the ground.
That's true. She, though, and that was the craziness of it, that she was a writer who just happened to be around murders all of the time mm-hmm. and helped them figure it out. You know, this casting, even with his parents, it really feels like casting for live action. Like, this is not typical voice acting casting. You're picking the people who could play them in live action for pretty much every role here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I forgot to mention Matthew Broderick as Adam Flamen, which is a weird name. I don't know where. That's not a pun. I don't know. Is it funny because it's a normal name? I don't know. But yeah, he played adult Simba. Voice acting was old hat to him by this point. But this was actually in a low period for Matthew Broderick because he had just been in the movie Deck the Halls. And ooh. I always think of the... There's an anecdote that was told on the podcast, How Did This Get Made?, where someone was working with him on the movie, and they were just waiting for a scene to start filming, and he just said, this is the bottom. We're at the bottom. And this is a man who took someone's life on the road. He has seen dark days.
It's, man, I feel like they only hired him because of the producers. Like, that he's so funny in the producers, and this is just him in the sidekick role again of like, hey, you can't do that. You shouldn't do this thing. Like, he's just doing his role for the producers, and they even write a song that's just over the credits that's entirely wasted.
Yeah, and you can tell where that song was supposed to go, and he was clearly hired to at least sing one song. So, yeah, Thinking Bee, that was a whole sequence in this film that was cut. But if you wait through, I don't know, 5 minutes of the 12 minutes credit sequence, you can actually hear it in full and understand where it should go in the film, which is weird because the finale has a Thinking Bee payoff that isn't really set up as well because there's no song.
Hearing that song over the credits made me hate the ending even more as an empty ending.
And we also have Chris Rock as Moose Blood, the mosquito. Obviously, you know it's Chris Rock the second this creature opens its mouth. So I guess that's enough said about that character.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing the broad. He was asked to do the broad Chris Rock thing, and he's doing it well. He wasn't asked to do much more.
And I'll call out more of the voices in the movie during the movie discussion segment. There's a lot more people in this. I just wanted to mention the main ones. But obviously, Larry King, Sting, Ray Liotta are here as the most notable cameos. And there were a lot more, which we'll talk about next in our secret B-movie expose section. So we're going to say goodbye to the free feed people. Goodbye, everybody. We'll see you behind the paywall.